Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by A Dozen Cousins, soulfully seasoned, ready-to-eat beans. Learn more at adozencousins.com.
This week on Meet & Three, it's all about screens. We're diving into the world of TV, computers, and even VR to figure out how food consumption is shifted by a digital lens.
Every course talks about a different topic within the Asian American identity through a very personal lens. And the three courses that are paired with VR, in it, you're seeing a brushstroke by brushstroke recreation of the dish that you're about to eat.
Most of us in the world live in urban areas. And so how much is the city already accidentally providing its residents? And how much more could it provide if we just made it a priority?
Tune in to Meet & Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live. What, you didn't get it? What's the matter?
I grabbed the wrong knob, but it doesn't matter.
Did we record it? Are we good? That's the intro, baby.
I'll do it again.
That's it, man. We're coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm coming from the Lower East Side in New York City. We have Nastasia the Hammer Lopez going to dial back in a minute. She got caught in her car. She's about to be back inside. We got our man John, your customer service representative extraordinaire, live from Murray Hill. Is that correct? You're Murray Hill right now?
Yep, correct.
Right. I got Matt in his Rhode Island booth. How you doing?
I mean, I couldn't make it 5 seconds into the show without screwing up, so we're doing great.
Yeah, all right. Well, you know. You remember that story I told you a long time ago about how I got real mad at Apple because their website wasn't working for like reserving a product that was coming out. This was years ago, and we had just had our huge snafu with our Kickstarter launch on the Searsol. And I was like, you know what? Mistakes happen. I think the same thing here. Mistakes happen. You know what I mean?
It's all right.
It's like every once in a while you need to realize that. I think everyone needs to realize that we all make mistakes. And so, like, while we hold ourselves to high standards, I hope, like, you can't get too bent over every little thing, especially if you can't fix it. Better to get bent over the stuff you can fix than the stuff that's already happened. No use getting bent over spilled milk or spilled blood, for that matter. You know what I mean? Okay, and special guest, friend of the show, and also our friend in real life, Ariel Johnson. How you doing?
Good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, and where are you doing well? Where are you coming in from here?
Greenpoint, Brooklyn.
Greenpoint? Is that where you live in Greenpoint?
I do live here, yeah.
Are you one of those people? Now listen, so for those of you that don't hang out in New York, here's what happened. So Greenpoint is an area that's serviced only by the G train. And back when, you know, I was young in the 90s and, you know, 80s, 90s, like you could basically say to yourself, if I have to take the G train, I've made a terrible life mistake. If the G train
that's
is my
that's a terrible train. Thing to say to her, Dave.
No. This is in the no. This is in
but
the
I,
80s, 90s.
So when I first moved to New York, this is in like 2005. Like the G train, or my perception of it, having ridden it, was that it was like very bad. But now, I mean, if you're willing to deal with the fact that it only comes every 10 minutes, it's actually, I think, the most reliable train in the system now.
Well, it's also where it's getting computerized, right? Didn't that one get computerized? It's also only
so.
Got like two cars on it or something.
It's got four cars. Yeah, it's a little short train.
But like for the past 8 years, it's been known where the hot hipsters go to meet other hot hipsters too, right? I mean, it's a good, like, people on it are either the old people who live in that neighborhood, which, you know, are like the people that I'm used to. And then there's like, you know, the younger set, you know?
Well, I definitely live and hang out more in the older, not hot folks part than the hot hipster part.
Yeah.
So in, I'm like, I'm over by the warehouses.
In 1997, I had a job working in a metal fabrication factory in Greenpoint. The crazy thing about Greenpoint.
There's two of those on my block.
the name of it was SFW Metals, which was literally stood for So Effing What Metals. That was what it was.
Excellent.
And we were making the project I remember is I made a stainless steel medicine cabinet for an incredibly rich Upper East Side person. And just sitting there sanding all day, sanding metal dust into my face. Anyways, so at the time, I lived up by Columbia. And so for those of you that don't understand how New York City works.
That's a long commute.
That's a long commute. Even though it's literally as the crow flies, 5 miles, it's like an hour. And it was like an hour and a half, especially back in the 90s. And man, I was like, man, Greenpoint, what the hell? I mean, like, unless you were an old school, like Polish, you wanted that old school like feeling, that for that, it was great. But also, you know, much like Bushwick, where we used to record this thing, it would be like, here's a family. Oh, look, right next door, here's someone dumping oil and car paint into the ground. Yeah. And you're like, what? You're like, I was like, the amount of like, the entire area used to be like a Superfund site because you'd have hardcore industrial people, old school style, like not like new green industry. Like, I mean, like literally like dumping oil into the earth.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's my memory. But now it's like so fancy, like Greenpoint's so fancy that most of the people that I know who live in Greenpoint, like they have no reason to leave it. It's become its own mini Brooklyn. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, it is literally Brooklyn, but.
Well, kind of, right? I mean, it's on the border.
And I also literally don't leave it. Usually now.
I mean, even pre.
No, no, totally. Totally. Yeah.
You know, you can get your tattoos, you can get your artisanal breads, you can get a good kielbasa. What else do you need, really?
Yeah, when I lived in the East Village years and years ago, and you could just like walk around and get everything you needed and never leave.
Yeah,
it's like that.
Yeah, and this is yet another episode for those that don't hang out in New York City that people from New York City, we all believe that we're somehow really worldly and that everyone else is provincial. And most of us don't leave 5 blocks from our house, which is a 5 minute walk radius. If you plant a compass, maybe 10, you plant a compass and you draw a 10 minute walk in a circle, 95% of us stay in that circle all the time unless we're going to work anyway.
Yeah. And then in our spare time, rather than high culture and all of the worldly things that we are supposedly involved in, we compare microgradations of neighborhood quality from block to block.
Yeah. That's how we do. That's how we do. So originally, you were talking to Nastassia and you were going to come on to promote your what was supposed to be book coming out very soon, but instead you pushed the book off for a couple of months. But you want to tell us what the book is, or you want to tell us what's going on?
Oh yeah, well, my book, yes. I've been working on it for a while, so I may have actually plugged it here before. Flavorama: The Unbridled Science of Flavor and How to Get It to Work for You. It is a handbook to the science of flavor, with a lot of friendly diagrams and explanations of how molecules and plants and volatiles and the brain and cooking work, and also with some recipes to help you understand those things and incorporate them into your cooking to become more intuitive and creative.
First of all, can I just tell you what a fantastic title that is?
Yo, oh, thank you.
Yo, Matt, do you have any reverb effects there?
Sadly, not now.
You don't have reverb? Flavorama! That needs to be on like severe reverb, man.
We could do it in post.
Yeah, add some reverb. I'll do it one time. I'll do it without the reverb. Flavorama! And then what's the slug underneath? What's the slug line?
Oh, the subtitle?
Yeah.
Oh, The Unbridled Science of Flavor and How to Get It to Work for You.
What if it was like the hardcore like Flavorama, like Sunday for Flavorama? And then it's like The Unbridled. And, like, you just like you go real droopy dog for the rest of it.
Yeah. That's good.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. So I love the title.
I don't even
care what the book has to say.
Yeah,
I wanna
great.
I wanna
well,
jump on this.
I mean, I guess marketing is more important than content. So
hell yeah. What's the cover look like on that thing?
Oh, we're working on that now. So it's probably going to have a molecule and maybe a cool drawing. Also,
she's doing like, all the drawings and like watercolor stuff. It's really cool.
You crazy, Ariel.
I know. Crazy. I love to make things extremely difficult for myself.
How many drawings do you have total, and how many of those are watercolors?
I think right now, drawings, I probably need to do like 100 more. And
out of how many?
There's going to be about 200.
So you're halfway done with the drawings.
Yeah. And probably like 15% are watercolor. They're all, so like I do everything. I sketch with pencil. Then I like to ink with either, like, for super fine lines, I use like a Staedtler or one of those like Sakura fine liners. But the pen I really like is a like German graffiti pen called a Molotov. I think it has like car paint or something in it. But it gives you like a really nice like India ink thick line, but with like fine nib control. And then
the Germans.
Yeah, exactly. To over engineer the most perfect material for any task, whether that's wonderful gardening tools or wool clothing or graffiti pens. And then some stuff I'm coloring in Photoshop, and then that's more for like concepts. And then for like real things, like a piece of fruit, I do watercolors.
But is the front, like, are you going to like cash in on that, like kind of like 50s, 60s Orama thing and like have like, pastel triangles on the front? Like those long, like chevron-y, like two-sided triangle BSs, you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, to make it look like a mid-century like physics textbook.
Yeah, yeah. And then with like, you know, with like a crazy molecule with the fake satellite spinning.
Oh yeah, electrons. That would be really fun. I'll have to like mock that up and.
But if I know you, you're gonna be like, but electrons don't do that. You're gonna be like,
You're using the Bohr model?
Yeah.
Like, you know better than that.
Come on, man. It's got to be space filling. It's a space filling model. But the space filling model doesn't fit the Orama, Ariel. It doesn't fit the Orama of it all.
Yeah, there's something about a probability distribution of an electron wave that is very accurate, but maybe doesn't have as much visual impact.
Not so Orama. Flavorama, where the wind comes. You get like Flavorama is such a great. That's not the key of Oklahoma, but that would be like. That's such a great title, Flavorama.
Thank you.
I want to know anyone out there that won't sign up to buy a book called Flavorama, because it also it makes it sound like it's going to be fun. Is it going to be fun?
I am trying to make it fun. Yeah, no, it's going to be fun.
There's 200 drawings in it, Dave. Of course it's fun.
You could buy it just as a picture book for the kids. That's how fun it's going to be. And by the way, you and I and all of us in Booker and Dax team still have to work on that secret project. I've done some research, but I haven't spoken to you about it.
No, I keep like doing a bit of research and then having to like put out a fire and then being like, I should really send this to Dave.
Like a literal fire or like a writing a book fire?
Right, no, writing a book fire, which are usually of my own creation. And I'm also still having a lot of fun working on Good Eats, which also sometimes has, gotta okay this model or diagram for the blackboard because we're filming it tomorrow. But
yeah, you're filming. Are you filming with mask? How's it work?
Not when I say. We actually, since they film in Atlanta and I am here in New York, but I believe they are all wearing masks. Maybe Alton is not wearing a mask when he films. We'll see, because the new season premieres very shortly.
For those of you that don't remember, Ariel is the first science officer, which sounds like a Star Trek title, but is in fact a title on the show Good Eats, right?
I am the Spock of Good Eats. This is true.
Yeah. Well, don't do that Spock thing where you go into the radiation and get yourself zapped, because unlike, you know, we can't mind meld into the other doctor and like come back later.
So. I don't have that superior Vulcan physiology.
Yeah. I mean, look, you know, whatever. So I have a question in for you, actually.
Okay.
So why don't we hit that one first? This one's on the Twitter from Chef Joanna. I'd love to hear Ariel speak about how cooking should be included in, by the way, what do you think, Ariel, about STEAM versus STEM as an acronym? Let me finish the question first, but just keep that in mind. In STEAM education, it's thermodynamics / organic chemistry / biology. I'm trying to get schools to adopt cooking science into their curriculum, and it's a struggle that's surprisingly difficult to overcome. Well, I mean, I don't know whether what she's talking about is the fact that it's hard to put it into one department, because usually classes are broken up by department. And as she says, cooking is so multidisciplinary from a science perspective.
It's true. And so many fields, like whether it's in the humanities or in the sciences, like kind of look down on their colleagues who do the food version of that thing.
Yeah.
It's just like an institutionalized.
But I mean, how would you do it though? Like if it, like it's got to be under a department, right? I guess not in a high school, but in a college, it has to be under a department. Isn't that part of the problem?
That is part of the problem. No, it's super. It's like really difficult to, to find a place where you can really like explore all of it. Because, you know, if you're focusing, or if you like find a home in a chemistry department, then you're gonna like shortchange the like biology. If you're in a physics department, you might not get all the like really important cultural and evolutionary stuff. And then if you're like, humanities department, then you can miss out on the science aspects, even if you cover like the anthropology really well. So that's difficult. I mean, I guess at like the pre-college level, you tend to have just like a science department, not just like chemistry. So that should be a bit easier. Yeah. I mean, I don't know, like there's a lot of really strong test cases that show that food and cooking are like really good for teaching science and getting young people engaged in science. I mean, Dave, you've been doing the Harvard course for like 10 years or more
Infinity.
At this point.
Yeah.
So if it's good enough for Harvard, it should be good enough for various other administrators, I think.
I don't know about that. And so for those of you that aren't involved in education or haven't been for a long time, STEM is, I forget what the acronym stands for, but it's like something.
Science, technology, engineering, and mathematics.
All right. So that was STEM. And then sometime when my kids were like in elementary school, they changed it from STEM to STEAM.
Yeah.
They added the A for arts.
The
hell is that?
But then, okay, so we've acknowledged that S, T, E, and M are all important, although there's a... Well, okay, by giving it an acronym, it's kind of like NASA. If you give it an acronym, it becomes important. Although I've often seen the argument and tend to agree with it that when people say STEM, they mean TE. So like... in terms of like putting young people into a job track that pays well and that is actually gets invested in, that's really technology, science, and mathematics like still really get the short shrift.
Well, the math people though have all those hedge fund weasels paying for it. Not that you guys are weasels. I'm just saying.
This is true. But then, I mean, that when math becomes that applied, isn't that like kind of a form of tech rather than pure mathematics?
Ooh, strong argument, Ariel. I appreciate it.
Joanna chimed in to say that she was focusing on grade school to high school. And I think in response to the arts, she was saying it's looked at like home ec, not like science.
Right. Totally. I mean, which is interesting. I mean, like, if you look at like the history of home ec and food science, like actually a lot of... technical and scientific work happened in the purview of home economics departments. But back in through the 60s, it was like, well, if women are doing it, it's home ec. So there's this interesting historical reasoning behind why we like write off the sort of exploration that happens in what we call home economics. that has historically not just been about like homemaking. But that's a question more for a historian than for a scientist who fakes being knowing things about history.
Yeah, right. Like that. Like you didn't have to deal with that in your doctoral thesis on bitters and whatnot. But the like it's interesting. Like I'm sure you've read and the cracklings were superb and like.
Oh yeah, I have a first edition copy of that actually.
Yeah. And the first, like, however many paragraphs of anything he writes is apologizing for writing about food.
Right, right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's kind of funny.
I mean, it is funny that, like, apologia of it. But, so, okay, but, like, going into practicalities, I would say if you're trying to incorporate food into a, excuse me, take that out in post, into a more like technically scientific focused curriculum. I mean, you know, school districts have like different things that are like fashionable that they're trying to emphasize, whether that's like ecology or like, a green ill type stuff. And I think fortunately the thing about food is that it touches so many things that it's kind of easy to look into either the like stated or unstated agenda of a school board or of a school's like mission and like find a food lesson that can fit those topics.
Yeah, cool.
If I had to do that, that's what I would try to do is, I'm getting to the point where I'm old enough that like I know how to make an impassioned defense of things, and people tend that doesn't always make stuff get done. So finding the most practical and easy for other people way to incorporate some ideas is often, I find, the key to actually getting something to happen.
I'm going to choose some of these questions here from our listeners that I think you might have something to say about.
Oh, okay.
All right. So, by the way, if you're on our chat room, Matt, how do they get into the chat room if they're actually listening to? I guess if they're listening to us, they can get on the chat room because it means they're on the website already.
Yes. I'll find the link. Give me 2 seconds.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, chat your questions in and Matt can read them to Ariel while we're going. But here we go. Solomon's writing in from San Antonio. Haven't been back to San Antonio in a long time. I'm creating a syrup that works for lattes and sipping chocolate from Kraft untempered single origin Ecuadorian Kraft small batch chocolate. That's a mouthful, is it not? Yeah. So the first method is 1 pound of chocolate, 1 liter of almond milk with sugar as a binder. Never made sipping chocolate before or Kraft chocolate. What are some things to try to experiment with? So like, have you ever had an experiment using the kind of untempered kind of gritty? I mean, I've never used it other than buying the Abuela like Mexican chocolate blanks and making hot chocolate with those.
Right, right.
You have any experience with this? Anything to?
I mean, I have had and have picked up some like Mayer Domo drinking chocolate from Oaxaca that's kind of like that. Although that tends to have like almonds in it too. Is there like an issue that he's having, or is it just a creative?
Just like creative. What are some things to experiment with?
Question.
Yeah.
So almond milk is interesting. I guess the idea maybe that it's trying to be vegan?
Well, it would be vegan since there's nothing in here that is not vegan.
That would be vegan. I just wonder if you might need some like protein to help. I mean, like normally like milk protein would help, like bind it together and keep it emulsified.
Well, the in other words, the native proteins in the almond milk don't have any of the effect that casein would. You need to add some garbage to it to get it to.
I mean, almond milk doesn't have a lot of protein in it.
Right.
It's mostly fat.
So how do they stabilize it? What do they add to it?
A lot of places add like guar gum or carrageenan.
Remember, if you add guar, make sure to get the flavor-free guar from Tick Gums. Flavor for NT1000 flavor. Dude, and just started tasting your hydrocolloid powders to see what you're kind of adding to your product, Yo, regular guar tastes like a pile of beans. I mean, it's a great name, but it is not a good tasting hydrocolloid in its normal, because think about this. Everyone's like, oh, it's made in a lab. No, guar is ground up seeds.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so like, you know, the ones that aren't like kind of purified well, it tastes like ground up seeds, and you do not want the whole wheat version of guar.
Sometimes more processing is better.
Oh, hell yeah. You just want the thickness on it. You don't want it to get all nasty. But carrageenan, I guess it's a non-acidic environment. Almost everyone from an industrial standpoint, ever since Gelan's patent ran out from CP Kelco, they're moving away from the carrageenans in their stabilized milk stuff. You know what I mean?
Oh, into Gelan's.
Yeah.
Those are like microbial, right? Or...
Yes, I don't remember what is the bacteria organism of choice, but okay. it's microbial, and CP Kelco's patent ran out I think a couple of years ago, because it used to be like, so for those of you that don't know, CP Kelco is the giant European based pectin concern, but they also have a bunch of patents, for instance, on Gelan, which, so Gelan is kind of cool because there's two main kinds of Gelan and they can be mixed back and forth. And the low acyl Gelan, this is confusing. The low acyl Gelan is brittle and short, and the high acyl Gelan is real stretchy, like a rubber band. So you can get these kind of gelatin style textures by mixing the two kinds of Gelan. And they have other cool properties, like the low acyl forms a very good fluid gel, which we can talk about if anyone cares. And it's also heat stable, so you can light it on fire. It doesn't melt out. So a lot of times when people were making what's called water desserts or water gels for hot climates, they would use agar, right? Mm-hmm. But the other great thing about Gelan is it's very low in use percentages. So much, much less than you'd use for most other hydrocolloids. Carrageenan had a very low in use ratio for dairy because it reacted extremely synergistically with dairy. So with Gelan, they were charging a lot more. They weren't trying to replace carrageenan. They were trying to replace other hydrocolloids, and they were charging a boat ton more for it. But they were like, but its in-use cost is so low. And typically, like, the lower the amount of a hydrocolloid you can use for a given textural effect, the less flavor masking there was. So one of Gelan's big things was you would get really, really good flavor release, you know, at the same in-use cost. But now that they're patent has run out, everyone's like crap on carrageenan because a bunch of health people are worried about these you remember what they're called, the degraded carrageenan? There's a word for the degraded carrageenan things.
Oligosaccharides, maybe.
I don't know, but there's some kind of, like, especially Kappa, there's some kind of degraded carrageenan that people say causes some kind of gut issue. And so, like, the vast majority of people have moved away from using carrageenan in things like chocolate milk or things like yogurts or cream stabilization, and have moved on to Gelan. But whatever. I digress.
Yeah.
So you could use some Gelan, Solomon. But But do they mean like flavor stuff? I mean, like the classic, the classic drinking chocolate would have been non-dairy anyway. I don't know what the nut of choice would have been in Mexico at the time, because almonds came from over here. But
it's true. Yeah, I'm not sure what the like filberts perhaps there were in the Americas. I'm not sure what the nut situation was.
Yeah, I should look it up though.
Yeah. I wonder if you're making a syrup with chocolate. It sounds like he's using like a chocolate bar.
Yeah.
Or is it like a cocoa powder?
I would bet bar, because there's no such thing as like, if you're doing like a minimally processed, they're not even tempering it. They're probably just grinding it on, you know, like a grinder to like a. You ever talk to Rick Bayless about his chocolate grinder?
I have not had the pleasure.
So, you know, he was saying he I don't know what it's called, but like the rotary style grinder, like we use, like the Santa or the wet grinder that we all buy, like the idli and dosa grinders, like the two stone ones that we all get from India. He had a similar one, you know, specifically for chocolate, like a mélangeur for chocolate. But he was saying that, you know, everyone who thinks from a European standpoint, they overprocess it because they want that texture, which he doesn't care about. But also they actually want those volatiles to go away. Whereas he says, you know, in his opinion, like, you know, part of the awesome thing about some of these kind of drinking chocolates are those volatiles that other people try to get to go away.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, you get like much more like botanical and microbial flavors, and maybe a little bit less on the like heat and processing derived ones.
Yeah.
So you could actually get more terroir from grinding it less.
Yeah.
I mean, an interesting like something I've actually been writing about recently is making all different types of things into all different types of like plant material into like milks. So like almond milk, other grain milks, sort of making that into orgeat. So I wonder if maybe instead of approaching this as like making a syrup with the like minimally processed and ground chocolate almond milk, why not make a milk out of the chocolate and some almonds? So like grind together like with water and do some like high blending and then straining. So then rather than ending up with
nibs.
Yeah. Start with nibs or start with like the partially ground chocolate. Don't add almond milk, but like blend everything together as if you were making cacao milk. And then kind of take it into a syrup from there.
That sounds cool. And by the way, for syrups for that, I would definitely look into a gum arabic / like small amount of xanthan thickened stabilizing system such as Ticaloid 210 or Ticaloid 310S available from modernistpantry.com. Or you can, I think we talked about it a couple of weeks ago, what the thing was. Ooh, Ariel, on the Twitter, I got another question in for you.
Okay.
Oh, we just got one in the chat too.
Oh.
Yeah. What do you want first?
Want to go for it? All right, chat's in. Oh, by the way, it is mixlr.com/heritageradionetwork. Really, go to any of the show notes, and the link is in the show notes. So Digital Audio Tape asks, for fermenting produce, e.g. sauerkraut, pickles, peppers for hot sauce, is sanitation / sterilization of jars / lids, airlocks actually important, or is it just busy work? My feeling is that lacto-fermentation with enough salt and acid production should be fine enough to make things safe and successful. Our ancestors just had clay pots and they did fine.
For that, we just had, well, and still a lot of people use pits in the ground for good and safe fermentation. So I personally don't sanitize things when I'm lacto fermenting, but I do give them like a good wash in hot water with soap. But it's like a star san as you would use for brewing beer.
So not like an SLS based detergent.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, sometimes I'll just like run it through the dishwasher, you know, on hot and just use it right out of the dishwasher.
Wow. So that's an actual good, because everyone used to make fun of dishwasher cooking. Remember when that was a thing?
Yeah. No, I don't run the cabbage through the dishwasher, but I run the jars through the dishwasher.
Yeah.
Wait, what was dishwasher cooking?
It was a thing.
Imagine sous vide, but inside the dishwasher because it's hot.
Yeah, and then everyone all at once was like, this doesn't work! Stop! You know what I mean? Anyway,
amazing.
Not safe.
I recently
like had a wooden handled spatula fall down on the heating element of my dishwasher, and all the stuff came out slightly smoked. So maybe that's a new
in a delicious way. Was water, it was water like smoking. An olive wood? Was it like an olive wood spoon or just like
no? It was just regular. I mean, it was regularly wood, so it just smelled like, you know, vaguely pleasant burning. But
No one's ever called my aroma vaguely pleasant.
This episode is brought to you by A Dozen Cousins, soulfully seasoned, ready-to-eat beans. A Dozen Cousins aims to bring families delicious and easy-to-prepare food inspired by traditional Black and Latino recipes. From their Cuban black beans made with onion, garlic, and bell peppers, to their Mexican cowboy beans made with green chilies and jalapenos, all the beans from A Dozen Cousins use easy-to-recognize ingredients like beans, vegetables, and nutrient-dense avocado oil, while avoiding GMOs and artificial flavors. Learn more at adozencousins.com.
Okay, so Wowie Zowie writes in, friend of the show, Hey to you, Ariel. I've been dabbling with lactoferments and always get pretty good results, but I'm wondering if there's a way to boost the acidity. I find that even after a long ferment, the pickles just aren't quite tangy enough. Should I cheat with lactic acid?
I mean, you can. Other things you could do are... Okay, so lactic acid comes directly from sugar and fermentation. So then what you'd want to make more lactic acid is to have the like starting concentration of sugar be higher. I suppose you could add some sugar, maybe a little like grape must or apple juice, which I've tried kind of specifically for this thing. It was for making more flavored brines. And it can work. If you add too much sugar, you run the risk of it getting quite yeasty. I mean, the other thing is if you slightly wilt some of your vegetables before you use them, some of the water evaporates away and that'll concentrate the sugars. So that's actually like an important part of making takuan pickles. Those are the daikon and rice bran Japanese pickles that you'll often get. The first step is to sort of hang up a bunch of daikons and let them partially wilt before salting and adding the rice bran to them to brine and ferment. So that like makes them make slightly less brine and also concentrates the natural sugars, which makes it more sour.
Speaking of rice bran, I have a whole bunch of wheat bran in my freezer that I'm saving up to do wheat bran pickles with.
Oh, to do like a wheat gnocco?
Yeah. But the thing is that like, I mean, come on, man. I mean, like we live in the real world here. Like everyone is like, if you don't aerate it all the time,
oh, it's never gonna stir it every day.
I know, come on, man. Like there's got to be some way to like put it in the fridge and halt it for a week and just do it once a week. There's got to be. My sourdough, I do that.
Probably.
It works great. You know what I mean? My sourdough works great. And I, you know, don't follow any of those, whatever. I don't know. What do you think? Have you had any experience with that stuff? Of not like of trying to make a low maintenance one of those?
Well, suckers? I mean, this is the thing is I mean, I love Nuka pickles. I am also not the most organized person. So I've had more of them just kind of die on me than I've had be successful. I did not think of putting them in the fridge, but that is a... I mean, that's a great idea. And there are actually a lot of fermentations that now, like, people, when they're experimenting, will tend to do them at room temperature or even heat them up. But, like, a lot of kimchis and things like that really benefit from, like, starting at room temperature and then basically fermenting entirely in the fridge. Mm-hmm. I was in Seoul in December, and... there's this restaurant/culinary studio called Ongium, where they do a lot of like primary and secondary research on like regional recipes for like cuisine of the nobility. Anyway, so it's like stuff that large households would be making. And some of the fermentations they they'll have like an oyster kimchi that's been in the fridge for 2 years and it's like amazing.
I bet. I would like to
taste it. You could actually get some improvement of flavor from this slow, cold fermentation.
That's the thing. I'll run a test. The problem is that I don't have that much rice bran pickling. I mean, I did it once at the FCI,
mm-hmm.
And then somebody pitched it because it was in a – that's the problem with the FCI. Students like, what is this? It smells weird. Right. Goodbye. You know what I mean?
Well, and you at a lot of restaurants, you have the classic thing of like one cook will start it out and then it doesn't get – tended all, but there's like a trail of like dead Nuka pickles.
Yeah. And then also like no one really talks about like exactly like how to know how much to add back in, whatever. Mm-hmm. It's a complicated thing. I'll work on it. Staying on the fermentation train for a minute, Bizu Chocolate wrote in to you and just mentioned that they're doing a deep dive into cacao fermentation this week.
Awesome.
And they're going to tune into what you're saying. So why don't you say something, give wise words?
Well, are they making or are they researching cacao
fermentation? Well, probably both.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's like I've looked into this some too. It's like a super... Well, most uninoculated fermentations is a super crazy thing. You get like a lot of like really, really interesting wild yeasts, a lot of like acetic bacteria doing stuff at the same time as like lactic acid bacteria. I mean, almost think of it like a sourdough, but on fruit. Although having said that, I think you could, if you're fermenting cacao fruits at home, if you have access to fresh cacao fruits, I'm very jealous. That's very cool. But yeah, if you're getting into like the beginnings of the fermentation, it could be really cool. Would be experimenting with like a mix of wild fermented and like inoculated cacao. Something that might work quite well if you can get your hands on it would be a Pichia yeast. That's like P-I-C-H-I-A. Those tend to be very good at, I know they make very fruity flavors. I believe it is releasing volatile sulfur compounds, although someone might correct me, that might be incorrect. But you tend to get like quite tropical aromas in things that use those yeasts.
Cool. You up for another fermentation question?
Oh, sure.
We have another one in the chat that's like an anti-fermentation question.
I'll go first then. Pablo Pavlotsky wrote in for you, can I make a garum-like sauce by mixing chunks of meat with kiwi, papaya, and pineapple? Man, it's going to beat that stuff up. Pineapple in the fridge for a long time. Would that work? I want the proteases to destroy the meat into a sauce, but I don't want to die or kill other people.
I mean, you should definitely try that experiment, but I can't give you any guarantee that it would either taste good or be safe.
Well, how do those particular enzymes work at the high salt content you need to prevent?
Well, that's what I'm thinking about, because he didn't mention salt, so I'm not sure if he's going to be including.
Yeah, Pablo, the answer obviously is salt. You can't do that stuff without salt, no matter what anyone else tells you.
Yeah. It's
he actually had written in, it was the same question in the chat, but he said, should I add salt to prevent the fermentation of the fruits in this one?
Well, I mean, the salt will prevent some of the fermentation of the fruits. The salt is also more so that like very dangerous bacteria don't take over the fermentation and possibly kill you.
Do you know what's really
although
delicious?
I think most garums and actually do have a little bit of fermentation that happens mostly from like very salt tolerant yeasts. So that would be, of course, now I am blanking on the actual name of that yeast. Oh, Tetragenococcus.
Can you say that again? I love that.
Tetragenococcus halophilus, I think.
That sounds like a now girlfriend I'm... someone had in Brooklyn in the 70s. You remember when we went out with Tetragenococcus?
Oh my god.
Yeah, so you do have some very salt tolerant yeasts and some bacteria that will actually do some fermenting. Although, what if you pre-fermented the fruit so there was some acidity and then added it to the meat with salt? That could do some interesting stuff.
Yeah. Do you know what tastes delicious? Lacto-fermented pineapple is delicious. Kiwi, I don't know. Papaya, woof. The idea of a fermented papaya makes me want to like jump off of a bridge.
Banana's really good.
Ooh, have I had that?
Lacto-fermented banana.
I've had fermented banana sauces.
Ooh.
Where was that from? Was it Filipino? I forget. I've had fermented banana sauces. But
very nice.
But straight up like fermented pineapple chunks, I've done it by mistake.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, sometimes it's real bad and sometimes it's real good. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So I would inoculate that sucker and see what's going on.
Yeah.
All right. A non-fermenting question that I will say what I think and then you guys say what you think. Casey writes in, I want to make a, quote, pretzel crouton. Mm. Is it safe to cut any regular bread, dip it in a lye bath, 1 to 20, and then bake? I ask because this means eating more lye directly than traditional pretzel. Looking at sliced bread on a slicer, then cutting circles as a garnish. Thanks, love the show, missed the blog. My take on this is that the lye is on a surface, right? You're going to get like instant deep penetration the stuff into the thing, and it's going to be entirely that soapy thing. So like I would say that it's going to be unpleasant, And B, it's going to be too much. And also remember that when you're doing a lye dip in a pretzel, there's still moisture in the product. You're slicing the bread. You've already flashed off a lot of the moisture. And so it's going to go from brown to black real fast once you add all that extra alkaline stuff. But I don't know, what do you think, Ariel?
Well, two things I'm thinking right off the bat is, yeah, to avoid this like lye sponge effect, maybe use sodium carbonate instead of lye. So like a much weaker source of alkali. I mean, the other thing is like maybe don't dip or spread it if you put some in a spray bottle and lightly misted the cubes. That might give you the effect that you wanted without oversaturating it.
Yeah, but still, I think starting from something that's already dry, it's just you're going to have to keep a real eagle eye on that thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that is true.
I mean, even like when you have a bread that's par dried that has a lot of have you ever made croutons from something that has sugar in it and it's like, oh no!
Right, like brioche or something, and it's like, yeah, let's burn now.
It goes from blonde to burnt like that. You know what I mean? Away. It's really problematic. You know, here's another thing, like crouton people, like you don't need to go to the oven right away. You can just let that sucker dry out for a little while first. You know what I mean? So that you're not trying to get all of the moisture out of the inside. Most people, they jack their temperature too high when they're doing croutons because they want those things to get out of the oven fast.
Right.
And so they it's a no-win situation. You really want a relatively slow dry, the same way that they would dry a real pretzel in the real life, which is down around 200 Fahrenheit in that range. You know what I mean? Just enough to... a little higher, enough to blast off all the water. It needs to be above the point where the water wants to leave over time, but not to where it starts browning hardcore. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Josh Seberg writes in, Joshua, sorry. Hello, Cooking Issues. A friend of mine has a desire to build a tandoor, but has no yard to do so and has pitched a plan to build one in my backyard. Yeah, yeah, of course. They're like, hey, yeah. I'm looking for advice on the best ways to do this and anything to be sure to do or include in the process. Thanks very much, Josh. Okay, well, as far as I know, and you know, I'm happy to be corrected, the only you should look, you get to choose one of these two. If you've never cooked in a tandoor before, right, then you can either spend a lot of time building a tandoor and then hoping that it has the right characteristics, right? Or you can get a tandoor from someone for not that much money and spend your time learning how to cook in a tandoor, right? but you know, if you're only going to do it a couple of times, then you know, I'm just trying to like you want to spend the majority of your time where you want it to be. Do you want to build a tandoor because what you want to do is build a tandoor, or do you want to cook in a tandoor, right? So just go there. I would try to get a copy of the only known tandoor book to me, Tandoor Cooking Book, by Ranjit Rai, Tandoor. He's now dead. The book may be out of print at this point. It's the only one. So it's not, and what's interesting about it is it gives an overview of actually constructing tandoors, but the way that they're really done. So this to dovetail, the classic way on the internet is the same way that Nastassia and I did when we, remember that film yep. with Anthony Bourdain?
Yes. Yeah.
We went to the hardware store. This is what everyone does. You go to the hardware store, you buy two flower pots, and then you cut holes, and flower pots are made of terracotta, and then you cut two holes. You cut a hole in the bottom to allow you to stoke it, and then you cut the bottom off of one, and you turn it upside down, and you have two inverted flower pots. And then, you know, if you're fancy Dan like we were, you mud it out with refractory cement, right? And then you put it inside of a trash can. And then, you pour some vermiculite on the bottom of the trash can. And then you pour a bunch of vermiculite around it. And there you have, you know, your one afternoon tandoor. So that tandoor, you can make it for like 50, 60 bucks. It's the trash can, the two flower pots, and a bag of vermiculite. And, you know, wear a mask when you're grinding off the top of the flower pot. But my experience is... even in that one day, of course, because we overfired it because it's us, right? But we cracked that flower pot. Now, it didn't fall apart instantly, but I wouldn't say that that tandoor would have lasted a long time, right, Stas?
Yeah, no.
Didn't you get one? Or you were calling around, right?
I was calling around, yeah. I'm not going to get into that.
Nope.
Stas is trying to get me to
go
to a bad place.
No, I'm not.
Yeah, so like... So like I called around, no one was selling tandoors, so I had to build one. So and in fact, we weren't even interested in tandoors per se, but it turns out that structure, that like kind of undergroundy or enclosed oven, is kind of an efficient way and was used all over Middle East, all the way over to China, in fact. And so it was kind of a ubiquitous thing that nowadays we only really associate with, from the Punjab down in Indian subcontinent. Anyways, actually, that's not true. I guess everyone nowadays is familiar with the tandoor style breads from the north and the west of China, right? Everyone's familiar with those things nowadays, but they weren't. I don't know, they weren't when we were doing this. So point being that if you just want to do something in a day and do it once, sure, go do that. But in the real life, the way that they're made is there's fibers in the clay. They're made, they're molded. You have to cure it in order to make it in order to get the right surface to actually cook a naan on, if that's what you're interested in. They have to be seasoned typically with things like spinach leaves and mustard oil and yogurt, and you fire it slowly over a couple of times to bake out any water so that it doesn't crack. So there's all that to go. I would say that of the ones I looked up on the internet this morning, seeing what people are talking about now, I would make sure that it has a bottom opening, not just vent holes like a Weber, but like an actual opening that you can pull ashes out while it's working and adjust the amount of air that's coming in and out. And make sure there's a nice curved inside surface so that there's area for you to put the breads in, but also for skewers to hang. And spend some time thinking about your skewer game. I never got very good with my skewer game. And a good skewer game is super important, because when you have your product and you're putting it in and then it slides down and drops into your coals and ignites, you feel like a jerk. In fact, you are a jerk, right? You should have had a better skewer game. The other issue is—
So how does one develop that technique?
You just got to get good at it. You don't put too much weight on it. You get the right kind of skewers with the right width so it has the right amount of grab. Mm. Like most people, they're using like the really slick stainless skewers, which are good for horizontal kind of grilling. Like, what was the name of that stuff that Mark used to use? Those little mini Italian or Croatian horizontal skewers does?
I don't remember.
But you know what I'm talking
about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so there's like, they're Croatian, right? Aren't they Croatian, those things?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So like those things, they're flat skewers, and the grill has little triangle shaped things so that you could put it in any position just by rotating it around the triangles. Anyway, so you get like four different positions with these skewers. Anyway, the smoother your skewer is, the more it's going to kind of drop off. So I would skewer the stuff on. Sometimes I would stick something on the end of it to stop it from sliding off. And then you got to hang it and let it dry out a little bit. And you want to organize your skewering such that when the meat seizes, it seizes around the skewer so that it doesn't want to come off. That's the trick. But the other big problem with tandoors is the intense amount of radiant heat coming off the bottom, because that's where the coals are. So especially in a smaller tandoor, which was what you're going to do, in a big, big, big tandoor, you can have a lot of stuff hanging in and you can keep it relatively far away from the heat on the bottom, and you're not going to get a lot of scorching on the bottom. But if not, try to wad up a ball of aluminum foil and just jam it over the end, and that'll shield it from the direct line of sight of the coals, which will burn your stuff off. Anyway, but the real tandoors, you can also, if you want to do this in the real, so my friend who first got me interested in getting a tandoor, Bob Datta, who's a professor over at Harvard. Ariel, you know Bob?
I don't think I do.
Anyway, he's a professor over at Harvard.
What does he teach?
Med school. He has a lab and he does one of his projects is rat olfaction, which is kind of
interesting. Oh, very cool.
Yeah. But he also has this thing where he developed a system to analyze the movements of rats via a computer so that you don't need to have a lab tech sitting there counting every movement that the rat makes when you're trying to do it, so they can get a lot more data a lot more accurately and a lot more quickly using this kind of visual recognition, machine learning thing. Hey, he's doing a lot of cool stuff. He'll win all the big prizes one day. Anyway, so he was like, when his grandma came over from the north, of India, when they came over to the U.S., the first thing the grandma did was dig a hole in the ground, like figure out whether the clay was good, you know, made the tandoor thing, put it in the ground and built it. I mean, if you want to be a super badass, that's what you do. You know what I mean? Of course, I don't want to be a super badass. So like, I think the minimum of badassery is to just, you can buy just the liner. And the nice thing about professional tandoor liners is that they have either grass or horsehair or something similar in the clay to hold it together during its initial firing. And this kind of prevents it from like instantly kind of cracking or causing problems. All right, tandoors, love them. And the name of that author of the book on tandoor, which there might be a new one, please someone tell me if there is, Ranjit Rai, R-A-N-J-I-T-R-A-I. All right. Okay.
So we got to go pretty shortly here.
Oh, geez, Louise. Let me see whether I have any more questions on the Twitter for Ariel, because the rest of this stuff I can probably answer on my own later. I think that's it. I think we got the specific questions for you.
Oh, great. Right, so well, I see. Love to clear out a to-do list.
Yeah. Well, no, this morning, because I didn't even know, because by the way, no one told me Ariel was going to be on. I mean, you're always, first of all, Ariel, always welcome on, obviously. No one told me, you. Squad. We like literally Nastasia and John and I at 11:30 last night, Eastern time, were on the phone with one of the factories that we're working with in China. And these two knuckleheads are having a conversation with themselves on text about you coming on the show tomorrow. They don't tell me. They don't.
My
tell
bad.
Me.
Well, we gotta keep you on your toes, right, Dave?
I guess. all right. So, John, which one of the four remaining questions that are in should I answer right now on the way out?
Let's see. I wish we could get to the barbecue sauce one, but that's long.
Well, why does Ariel have something to say about the barbecue sauce one? I haven't read that one yet.
All right. Well, so basically, Chuck Ramsey at Pulaski Heights Barbecue in Atlanta. Sent in this question, I think it's last four times he's made this barbecue sauce. It's set in a very weird way once he refrigerated it. He says it's very pectinous, if that's a word. And he's been making this recipe for years and years and years and thousands of times, and it's never been an issue except for these last four times. And he's always weighed everything to the gram, so he's ruling out user error, and everything else is basically like spices and a little vinegar. So he thinks it's the ketchup. And is wondering if it's maybe fermenting or if there's an excess yeast in the atmosphere that's doing something. I think that's the best way to sum up that.
By the way, he's using Heinz, America's favorite ketchup. Yeah. So the ingredients, Ariel, are Heinz ketchup, yellow mustard, but doesn't specify seed or a prepared mustard, right? Because there's a lot of gelling agents in mustard seeds.
But if it's yellow mustard, is that like French's?
Well, that's what I'm saying, but is it yellow mustard seed? Like the white mustard seed,
or is it
yellow prepared mustard? Yeah, like French's, because like those prepared mustards don't have a lot of
French's. Just in the order of which he's listing everything, it sounds like it's wets and then the dries.
Yeah, molasses, white vinegar, ancho chili powder, kosher salt, black pepper, onion powder, garlic powder, and allspice. Not cooked, blended together, and it's always stored at room temperature.
Okay,
I kept it at home in the fridge for a number of years. And it's only the last three batches that are causing problems.
So it's like setting like a jelly.
But the weird thing is that you wouldn't think that Heinz would change their recipe. Like
the, right,
like,
to include more pectin or something.
Or to add a thickener so that they could put less tomato in.
Right.
Like if I was Heinz, what I would do is I would reduce the amount of tomato solids because that stuff's expensive, and then I would add a thickener to it to make it seem like it had the same amount of tomato solids. That's what I would do if I was going to be a jerk.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But I don't think. I mean, like, I don't think Heinz. I think I would have heard someone would have said, "Hey, Dave, America's favorite ketchup has just dropped the ball."
Right. I mean, because it would be on the label then, at least in the ingredients list, there'd be a change.
Yeah. But I don't see anything else that would cause kind of a reaction. So,
I mean, so saying that it's pectinous makes me wonder if it is actually the pectin. And to form a gel properly, like in jam, pectin like can't really do it on its own. It needs both sugar and acid to do that. So I wonder if like any other ingredient has become more sugary or more acidic, that could throw off the like physical gelling of whatever pectin is coming from the tomatoes.
Yeah. It's also like, wait, so it thickens and then it gets grainy as if the dry spices are blooming, followed by a separation with a dark liquid component.
Mm.
And then a few days it develops an acetone off flavor, which I assume is from yeast over fermentation. So, I mean, look, I mean, I guess it's possible that there's some sort of, like, pectin can all of a sudden act weird, like if the acid suddenly changes or right. like you say, the solid suddenly changes, they can set, and a misset pectin is a nasty thing. But graininess also sounds like there's a lot of hydrocolloid interactions that can be grainy and disgusting, like agar sometimes interacts with agar. I forget what the interaction is. Agar gelan gets real grainy, but there are some like weird hydrocolloid interactions where two different polysaccharides don't play nice. And I wonder whether if any of the ingredients you've added have changed their makeup or not. You know, I mean, does this sound or like? Have you ever heard of something like this? It's also very acidic already, so I would doubt that a slight shift in acidity based on fermentation would cause this to happen, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's
what sounds. What about the acetone off flavor?
Yeah, that I'm thinking about too. That's a, although like, you don't really eat a lot of acetone like flavors from either yeast or lactic acid bacteria. You can get some from acetic bacteria, but then you'd have to have some alcohol fermenting.
But like, aren't like acetone-y things from plants usually like enzymatic breakdown things? Not like yeast breakdown stuff? Like bananas, like when they overripe, they get acetone-y, right?
Well, like, I mean, okay, so it depends on if it's like literally acetone-y, or I mean, some of the like banana overripe flavors could just be coming from like excessively high concentrations of natural esters, the smaller ones of which can have a kind of chemical edge at higher concentrations, and then at lower concentrations they just smell like banana.
Yeah. What do you think? Maybe
so you could have like some acetone. I mean, you do produce acetone like from yeast. It could actually be more of an ethyl acetate smell, and that you can get either from like wild yeasts or from like incomplete fermentation into vinegar.
Yeah, I mean, like, so then he says that he made a batch and he kept one container in the walk-in in the, you know, low 30s and one out, and the one that was out got grainy and the one in the fridge thickened but isn't grainy yet. So something is happening here.
Yeah, and you're getting like a phase separation.
Yeah, well, as soon as something breaks in flocks, you're going to get hard phase separation. You're going to get a lot of liquid coming out.
Right.
Like as soon as something, first of all, what we used to call that in the hydrocolloid biz is synaresis. So
exactly.
Yeah, the harder a gel sets, typically, and some things are more likely to synerese than others, but like a weakly set kind of thixotropic pectin mix, which is what ketchup is, it's like a bunch of like, you know, as soon as you make that harder and it starts squeezing on the water harder, you're going to get phase separation. And if things start actually agglomerating, you'll get graininess. You'll get like flocculation and graininess. So something like that has to be happening. I wonder whether the salt level has changed. I mean, I just don't know. Something has changed. If it's something that's living, do this, Chuck. See what you think, Ariel.
Mm-hmm.
Put some of this stuff in a zippy the day you make it and throw it into water at like, you know, 75 degrees Celsius, and then like just like pasteurize it, right? Pasteurize it, kill all the stuff in it. I don't think there's many spore forming things that are going to be causing this, and see whether or not that thing goes through the process. Don't take it to a high enough temperature that you're going to functionalize pectin. So maybe even in the mid to high 60s, right? Celsius. Just pasteurize it, kill any yeast, kill any lactic acid bacteria that's in it, and see whether it goes through the same process. That'll let you know whether it's something alive that's doing it or whether one of your ingredients changed. Do you think that's a decent first step?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you could also do a third control where you just put it in a baggie and leave it out on the counter and see if it produces any gas.
Good point.
Because that would also be a good check for fermentation.
And speaking of bags, on the way out, I want to know for next week if anyone has any experience with these things. You heard of these stasher bags, Ariel?
Those are like the silicone ones?
They're silicone, and I saw one in the supermarket, and they're overpriced, right?
Right.
But I bought one for a couple of reasons. One, it's a woman-owned business, so I appreciated that. And two, and I love, like, you know, in the food tech thing, you definitely want to support that. But two, it's made of silicone, which, guess what that means, people? You can use it as a retort bag. So what I'm going to do, I have it. I don't know if you can hear it. I'm going to try to do a pressure cooker confit in it that's actually retorted and safe to store in the vacuum.
Oh, what
cool. do you think?
Very yeah. cool.
Yeah, I'll report back.
Please, yeah. I mean,
yeah. So I'm trying to figure out a way to get a good air seal on it because it doesn't have one of those one-way valves on it. You know what I'm saying?
Right, right.
But I don't know. If you guys
like
have
a syringe,
have any,
maybe? Or?
I tried my old school. My zippy technique is I have a bunch of metal straws, thin ones.
Right, right.
And I zip it all the way over to the edge and then I...
Yeah.
And then pull the straw
out
at the last
second. That's what I do.
Yeah, yeah. Very high tech people. This is how the actual high tech people do it with like straws and Ziploc bags.
It's like I could break out the food saver, or yeah. I could just put a.
And honestly, people, when you're packing baked goods in your freezer, so like what you should do, especially in the time of Corona, if you do make a baked good, right, slice it and then zippy it. Separate it with layers of freezer paper so they don't freeze together. But like that straw, your lungs are terrible vacuum pumps. So you can't really even get like a full like 3/4 of a PSI under pressure, right? Really, 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 really weak vacuum pumps. So the good news though is that's just enough to get the bag to make a nice kind of conforming thing around your muffin or whatever, but not enough to crush it. So if you're putting in a food saver, which has, for as crappy as that vacuum pump is, it's a lot better than your lungs, right? And so like those things have a tendency to crush baked goods, whereas straw with a zippy is the best way to get the most air out of a Ziploc bag for baked goods to be put in your freezer, because you really don't want a lot of air rattling around the bag, because that's when you get a lot of crystals growing on it, sublimation and crystals growing back on it, and you get more opportunity for freezer burn. You know what I mean?
Hell yeah.
Well, Ariel, when is the book now slated to come out?
Early 2022, it looks like.
2022? I have to wait a whole nother freaking year? 2022?
Well, it's going to come out in late fall 2021. So it's not a big postponement.
It's got 100 drawings to do.
Look. Look. I'm not one to talk. Nastasia, here's where you insert Nastasia making fun of me.
Oh, have you ever turned in a book on time?
I've only turned in one, and it was horribly late. But this one is even more horribly later. If that's a...
So when's yours coming out? Or is that a bad question to ask?
I mean, I don't know. I got to hand it in first. But like what's interesting is that having talked to a couple other people who are coming out with books now mm-hmm. is like some of them are going through this incredibly short cycle. So like...
Yeah. 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 That happens.
Yeah. So it's like... But that used to be just for like, you know, books about politics and whatever, you know what I mean? Topical events. But now I'm seeing books that, you know, I know were handed in like only 6 months ago coming out now. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, wow, how the heck are they doing that? You know, like how, cause it used to be a full year,
right,
you know what I mean?
Right.
After it was handed in for it to come out. So I don't know. So I thought maybe you had more insight into that. That's why I was surprised at the 20s. Well, look, I can wait. But hopefully you'll let me see the galleys. By the way,
I mean absolutely. But likewise, I'd love to have some eyes on yours.
I'll send you stuff as it goes. But people, make friends with authors so that you can get to see their galleys, right? But here's the problem:
a lot of places are moving into only digital galleys now.
Yeah,
with Corona. Yeah.
But here's the issue. So if you are friends with authors and if you're a creative person in a field like this, the hardest thing, and I've actually not read certain things, is because if someone in a book gives you knowledge, right? It's hard not to use that knowledge. And you can't credit the book because it's not out yet.
Right, right.
You know, especially like things like recipes or cooking ideas or things like this. It's like, it can be difficult. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's why I don't like NDAs. I mean, I've signed them with you before, but like, not that I want.
We made you sign an NDA.
Oh, for the Searsol back in the day.
Oh yeah.
Not that I don't like NDAs, like exploit ideas, but like, the information is going to be in my brain, and I can't really like control like what else it makes me think of.
Yeah,
not for like exploitation of money, since I barely ever make any money. But just like literally, my brain's gonna use it for something.
Yeah, it's happened to me multiple times. Yeah. It really is a thing. It really is a thing. Oh, I'll leave you guys with this. So I'm not going to talk about the politics of it because, of course, we don't do that. But I learned a phrase yesterday that was in the news: free chicken.
Wait, what?
And I was like, that. Well, you weren't tuning into the news?
I was not tuning
into
the news.
Remember Vindman?
Yes.
Lieutenant Colonel Vindman? So he says that in the military, when you get something for free that you didn't even ask for but you kind of want, you just call it free chicken. How awesome a phrase is that? Free chicken. I'm just going to use that for everything now. It's like, oh, it's because normally I'm like, oh, gravy.
Who would say no to some free chicken?
No one says, well, you know, vegetarians, but like,
sure, but
you know, but like, it's like, usually I say, hey, it's gravy. You know what I mean? But yeah. Somehow free chicken is more like, cause it's the thing. Cause gravy, you still need to have something else. No one drinks gravy.
Eat it with a spoon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, like that's the thing. You're like, oh, that gravy. You're like, wait, what the hell does that even mean? Like free chicken, you could do something with. You know what I mean? Anyway. Well, Ariel, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's always it's always a highlight.
And we'll look forward to your input on this next season of Good Eats.
Right on.
And let us know more about the book, and we'll talk soon. Cooking Issues. Cooking Issues is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.